We're live. Jeff Lipke, do you have anything to say to the world?
No, I do not.
Okay. Let me open us up in prayer. Father in heaven, we're grateful for the chance to come this morning to worship you by studying you, to worship you by learning things that are from you that are going to strengthen our faith and are going to give us confidence to share your truth. And so I pray, Father, as we gather here today to look at these things, to ask these questions, to answer questions, that you would be guiding us by your Spirit and opening our hearts and minds to what you have for us. Pray this in Christ's name. Amen. All right, so we left last week kind of finishing up with the cosmic constants and went through kind of the laundry list of cosmic constants that exist in order for life to be sustained. And some interesting things to point out again, like number three and four, eliminate 99.9% of the stars, and they would fail to meet the necessary conditions to sustain life. And so we moved through those things and we looked at order, and we concluded that order doesn't come out of chance. Chance or accidents don't produce order. If they did, it meant order would exist without a proper intention, and we don't ever experience order happening without a purpose or an intention. And so it would be inconsistent with our general trend of experience and what we know as far as the world around us. So we have to conclude that order must have come about by something other than chance. And there's really only one other explanation. And so we look to this idea that it must have had an intelligent beginning if there is order. And so we know order comes from intelligence, but we are told the order we see is without purpose, purely by chance, and we wonder how probable this would be. How probable is it that this order would exist by chance? And so we're going to look at an argument that's called the probability argument, and it takes in a bunch of information, so let's dive right into it. The idea that all necessary factors arose at the right times and in the right place by chance seems highly improbable, and we wonder what the actual probability is. Well, let's take a look. There's three things that life must traverse, or three necessary conditions that have to take place for life to happen. Okay, the first thing is a life-sustaining universe. We must have a life-sustaining universe. The second thing is a life-sustaining planet. So we move from the outer life-sustaining universe to another level, which is a life-sustaining planet. And then the third thing is the evolution of advanced life. So in order to be sustained, life must traverse three levels of probability. And these are the three: life-sustaining universe, life-sustaining planet, and the evolution of advanced life. If the first two conditions are satisfied, then the only problem remaining is that of life forming from non-life and attaining an order as high as man. Now, this is where the fun stuff begins, because we're going to get into some serious probability problems for mathematicians and scientists who only allow a certain level of probability for something to be considered probable. Okay, molecular biology has revealed a vast gap between the living and non-living world. The most complex non-biological system is vastly different from a single cell. A one-cell organism is far more complicated than anything in our technology. Being that this is where life begins, it is an appropriate place for us to start today. So we're going to look at what is required for the formation of a cell. Okay, one cell, a single cell, what is necessary and required. The process begins with amino acids. Amino acids, as our doctors in here would hopefully concur. Life begins with amino acids, would you say? Probably? Okay, good. We're right so far. Okay, they are evenly divided into two classifications, left or right-handed, and only the correct type, left-handed, must link together in a specific sequence in order to produce a protein molecule. A protein molecule. And again, this stuff is all coming from Lee Strobel's book, Case for Christ. Now, this requires assembling approximately 100 amino acids the proper way. However, there are at least 80 different types of natural amino acids, and of the half that are left-handed, only 20 are found in protein molecules. Okay, so we're getting down to the basics here. But protein molecules are not cells. You must then assemble approximately 200 proteins which properly relate to each other to get a living cell.
So Ms. Moore, what is the probability?
I'm sitting here thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm working with me.
Don't worry, I'll tell you. Okay, so assuming there actually was a prebiotic soup, okay, a primordial soup or something of that sort, of ideal conditions, what is the probability of this taking place by chance? Well, here we go. The chance of a single protein forming randomly, so not even a cell yet, but a single protein, is 1 in 10 to the 65th. So that looks like...
Got to look at you.
Thank you. Would that be what we're looking at here, Tanya? So one times...
Can you write that out the long way, please?
With 65 zeros? That's a lot. Okay? So 65 zeros after that. The chance of proteins forming a single cell, or life, is 1 in 10 to the 40,000th. So that would be 1 times 10 to the 40. Okay. So again, that's a 10 with 40,000 zeros behind it. I won't write that one out. Okay. So the chance of the evolution of a human being is reported by Carl Sagan, Crick, and Merkin to be 1 in 10 to the 2 billionth. Okay. Let's write that up. Is that right? Is that 2 billion?
Yes.
And that's life, or that's human life. Human being evolving from a single cell. And Barrow and Tipler estimate it to be, their numbers, I don't know what they are. Okay. 1 in 4 to the 180 times 110 million. And 1 in 4, here, I'll write it out here. See if I can do this right. That's a lot, right, Tanya?
Yeah, kinda.
Kinda. Okay, and then they say it's between these two figures.
The first is 19.8 billion.
Yes.
So your calculator goes that high?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're saying it's between these two, somewhere in between these two figures, and then Carl Sagan says it's that one right there.
Yet they think it is.
Right, and we're going to get to how they argue against this. Okay, so we have all those figures.
Yeah.
Dustin, if you were to calculate that in the form of dollars, that'd be a lot. A lot. Okay, so right now it seems highly improbable. Okay, of life by chance, by random chance, forming even a single cell, or actually a protein, then going to a single cell, and then moving to a human being. It seems highly improbable. And I forget, what is the science, I don't know if you know this, but there's a certain level of improbability that a scientist just considers it as a non-issue. I forget what that level is. I think it's like 1 in 10 to the 10 or something like that. I think it's pretty low. Anyway, so their objection is to all of these improbabilities, okay? These are scientists. These are mathematicians. These are professionals. They have PhDs and a lot of letters behind their names, and they've studied this exact stuff. And their response to these improbabilities is simply, it must have happened because we're here. So improbability is irrelevant. Must have happened because we are here, so improbability is irrelevant. When you discuss simply the improbability of it all, given enough time, it will eventually just happen. And so you notice, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but as we've been getting older, they've had to add more years to the age of the Earth. And it's usually by the billions, right? At first it was like we were 10 million years old, And then it was, well, we're 100 million years old. And now it's 4.5 billion years old. Like, they need more and more time in order for all of the stuff that they're arguing about to happen. So they just need more and more time. So they just add more time. It's that infinite regress. They're actually using it. The age of the earth just keeps getting older. Okay. Okay, we're going to have you consider a scenario. Okay, so you need to close your eyes to envision the scenario. You can, but you don't have to. You are an outlaw in the 1800s, has escaped to Mexico, but has been captured there, and you are brought before a firing squad for execution. So it's the 1800s, you've been captured in Mexico, and you're an outlaw. After seeing the six sharpshooters awaiting you, you are tied up and blindfolded. You then hear the countdown, ready, aim, fire. You hear the guns go off, and yet you notice that you have survived unharmed. You would be understandably surprised, but what might be the possible explanations for this occurrence? So you think through. Well, first of all, they all missed by some odd chance. Okay, so I better pretend to be dead or else they'll really shoot me. Number two, they all missed on purpose, just trying to scare me. Okay. What I actually heard were six other guns that shot the executioners before they could shoot me, and I being rescued. Or four, someone loaded the guns with blanks. Okay. All four scenarios are unlikely, but which is the least probable? The one that you would eliminate first. What do you guys think?
They all missed?
Yeah, that somebody shot. Six other people shot.
So that the rescue attempt, how many think that they all missed?
The least probable.
Least probable. Okay.
I've got a lot of friends. Of course they would come and rescue me.
How many think it was a rescue attempt and six other, and somebody shot the others? Okay. That's the least probable. It's the most unlikely thing that could
have. I can prove that.
Okay. And so it's interesting that that they missed by some odd chance. How many picked that one?
Seven.
Okay. A lot of people. It's funny that even amidst four really improbable scenarios or explanations, that chance seems to be the one that we find to be the most improbable out of all of those. So I gave you different scenarios, and yet it seemed the most improbable thing that could have happened is they missed by chance. Yet, amidst the improbability, many scientists and teachers out there are saying, well, even though it's the most improbable, that's probably what happened.
Why is that?
A variety of reasons. I think maybe that's what they were taught. It comes from their worldview.
Can't argue with it.
Because they don't want to accept the alternative.
Yep.
So they would much rather not have truth and just go with the flow?
Possibly. Pride probably plays a lot into it. They don't want to be wrong. Some of them have studied years and years and years, and they don't want to give up years of study books they've written. That can play a big part in it. It's fascinating to me that one atheist philosopher that I don't know, and Ed, you may know this, if he was big on evolution, Anthony Flew, was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, and he's a prominent atheist philosopher in Great Britain, and he was adamantly against Christianity. And 2 years ago, I mean, he's written tons and tons of books on atheism, and 2 years ago, he concluded that there must be an intelligent designer. There's no other explanation that is more likely than the chance that there's something out there that is coordinating the events. He's not a Christian. He didn't go that far yet. But he's concluded that there is a God.
So does that rock the scientific world at all? Or?
Well, it's funny because he was attacked more by atheists than he was cited by Christians. There was actually, if you go to Lee Strobel's website, he has an interview with Dr. Flew as to what happened. And Anthony Flew talks more about his assault by other atheists and how they condemned him as weak-minded. And they just basically said, all of your life's work means nothing. And they just wrote him off because he didn't fit into the formula anymore. And it's just fascinating that they wouldn't even appeal to, okay, this is a guy we've respected, that we've read his books, we've studied him. Why wouldn't they be curious as to why he's concluded this? Instead, they just said, no, lost another one. He must be emotional or something.
Lee Strobel says it takes more faith to believe that there isn't a God than it does to take.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, that's true because when we start looking at the fingerprints that God has left on this planet and the fact that just around every corner and the more powerful our microscopes get, the more we see evidence of God. In college, there was this guy studying for his PhD in molecular biology. And when I first met him as a freshman, he had just finished his master's degree or something like that. And he would have debates with me about atheism and everything. And then I saw him in the weight room 4 years later, and he had just come back from Germany and studied there for 2 or 3 years. And we were talking, and I was just asking him how things were going. And he said, "You know what I discovered over there?" I'm like, "What was that?" He said, "As I started to look under microscopes and I saw how microorganisms functioned and how they organized themselves and the processes that they did to survive," he said, I had no question that there must be something organizing all of this. I don't know what that is yet, but I'm going to get to the bottom of it," kind of thing. And it was, you know, the more he looked at smaller and smaller things, at an infinitesimal structure, he identified a God of the universe. He just didn't know what it was called yet, or what he was called yet. So, anyway, interesting stuff. So it's funny that when all else fails, we appeal to chance sometimes. Not we, but humanity. So one of the things that we're going to look at now is irreducible complexity. And I don't know if you can see it. You're going to probably more want to hear it than anything. Blanks. Oh, the two objections? Oh, yeah.
Here that we exist.
Okay, yeah. That must have happened because we're here, so improbability is irrelevant. First thing, this assumes there to be a limitless amount of time, and thus an infinite past. And like I was saying, they just continue to add more time because they need more time for things to have happened, so they just add more. It's very handy. So this assumes there to be a limitless amount, and thus an infinite past. It also disregards evidence and begs the question of how. For an area of study or a profession that basically all of their livelihood is based on evidence, and answering the question how, that this response, given the amount of evidence and the figures of improbability, they disregard the evidence, and it begs the question of how, which is the very thing they are in their profession to do, is look at evidence and answer questions. So those are your two blanks there. Okay. A little while back, a doctor by the name of Michael Behe, and there was a group of scientists that got together that were starting to become disillusioned with science as an evolution, basically. They had all grown up knowing Darwin and reading, and that was the foundation for what they were doing, and he's a molecular biologist too. And a bunch of scientists got together, I think on the California coast in some beach house for a weekend, and they started talking about, well, what do we do? You know, it was almost like they were behind the cover of darkness because they shouldn't be questioning the almighty Darwin. And they were, well, what do we do if this is right? How do we go forward with this stuff? And so Michael Behe and some of his friends are the ones that first started coming up with intelligent design as a scientific position. And he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, where he kind of reveals some of the things that even Darwin himself conceded. He said, if these things don't come about, then my theory is bunk. And so Michael Behe kind of points that out. So Lee Strobel here is going to interview Michael Behe and talk to him about irreducible complexity, which is what into intelligent design. And yet, you get to see who Lee Strobel is. So if you ever thought he looked a certain way, you're left behind.
Throughout the second half of the 20th century, spectacular technologies revolutionized scientific understanding of the cell, the basic unit of life. During an interview with biochemist Michael Behe, Strobel learned how this new knowledge has shaken the foundations of Darwin's theory.
In the 19th century, when Darwin was alive, scientists thought that the basis of life, the cell, was some simple glob of protoplasm, like a little piece of jello or something that was not hard to explain at all. But with the hard work of science in the 20th century, we've seen that the cell is far from simple. It's got very complicated molecular machines and things that are very resistant to Darwinian explanation.
Michael Behe has devoted his career to the study of the design and operation of the cell. He has also written extensively on the biochemical challenge to evolution.
Most people have no idea of how small and complex cells are. A typical cell from you or me, called a eukaryotic cell, is probably a tenth of the size of the head of a pin. And yet, in that single cell, there are about 3 billion units of DNA making out the chromosome. And those 3 billion units make the molecular machines of the cell, literally machines that make the cell work.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell. Here, the staggering complexity of its molecular machinery is clearly seen.
It's like going into an automobile factory. The factory has a large number of machines. The parts have to fit together in very specific ways to do their jobs. And if they go wrong, the cell is in big trouble. And just one cell is enormously complex. But humans, you and I, are made from trillions of cells. And those trillions of cells have to fit together in the right way and do their own job. Darwinism was a lot more plausible when we were thinking about blobs of protoplasm than it is when we're thinking about molecular machines.
Each of these biochemical machines is a masterpiece of engineering and nanotechnology. They are essential to functions as vital and diverse as vision, photosynthesis, and the production of energy in the cell. Michael Behe has studied several of these machines, including the flagellum, a remarkable rotary motor.
I remember the first time I looked in a biochemistry textbook and I saw a drawing of something called the bacterial flagellum with all of its parts and all of its glory. It's had a propeller and the hook region and the drive shaft and the motor. I looked at that and I said, that's an outboard motor. That's designed. You know, that's no chance assemblage of parts.
Behe's reaction was not surprising, especially when the bacterial flagellar motor is animated and magnified more than 50,000 times to display the details of its construction and operation.
Howard Berg at Harvard has labeled it the most efficient machine in the universe. These machines, some of them are running at 100,000 RPMs and are hardwired into a signal transduction or sensory mechanism so that it's getting feedback from the environment.
It's got some tail proteins which act as the propeller. When the flagellum rotates, these push against the water and therefore push the bacterium forward. And the motor uses a flow of acid from outside of the cell to the inside of the cell to power the turning.
The bacterial flagellum has two gears for reverse water cool, proton motive force. It has a stator, it has a rotor, it has a U-joint, it has a drive shaft, it has a propeller. It's not convenient that we give them these names. That's truly their function.
In all, about 40 different protein parts are required to build a flagellar motor. Half of them are constructor proteins, specialized mechanisms that assemble the flagellums into components. Since its discovery, biologists have tried to understand how a machine of such superb design could have arisen gradually, without foresight or plan, through the biological pathway Darwin envisioned.
I think what Darwin was trying to show was that things that look designed aren't really designed, but that we can find naturalistic processes to account for the complexity of life. Darwin theorized part of every living organism evolved through natural selection, a blind process that acts upon random changes in the cell.
Darwin believed that given enough time, these random variations would transform the simplest cells into the great diversity of life that inhabits our planet. In his study of evolution and molecular machines, Michael Behe has raised a significant challenge to the creative power of Darwin's mechanism of selection. It is called irreducible complexity.
Irreducible complexity was coined by Mike Behe in describing these molecular machines. Basically what it says is that you have multi-component parts to any given organelle or system in a cell, all of which are necessary for function. That is, if you remove one part, you lose function of that system.
Irreducible complexity can be illustrated by a familiar non-biological machine, a mousetrap. The trap is composed of five basic pieces. A catch to hold the bait, a strong spring, a thin bent rod called the hammer, a holding bar to secure the hammer in place, and a platform upon which the entire system is mounted. If any one of these parts is missing or defective, the mechanism will not. All components of this irreducibly complex system must be present simultaneously for the machine to perform its function. Catching mice. The concept of irreducible complexity also applies to biological machines, including the bacterial flagellum.
All told, there are about 40 different protein parts which are necessary for this machine to work. And if any of those parts are missing, then either you get a flagellum that doesn't work because it's missing the hook or it's missing the drive shaft or whatever, or it doesn't even get built within the cell. You can't put something like that together gradually because they need a large number of parts interacting with each other at the same time before they work at all.
Without the tools to observe the machinery of the cell, and long before the idea of irreducible complexity, Charles Darwin offered a way to test his own theory. In Origin of Species, he wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down."
Darwin acknowledged that if someone identified a biological system that could not have been constructed in incremental steps over long periods of time, then his theory would be invalid. And what Michael Behe and others have discovered is the existence of biological machinery that cannot be explained away by Darwinian processes. Darwin's failed predictions have in fact falsified his own theory.
Again, that's Lee Strobel's For a Creator. And that's a great DVD just to watch from beginning to end. But here are the handouts on irreducible complexity. We'll go through this again. Make sure you guys understand.
Didn't Darwin at the end of his life admit that he was going off before he died?
I don't know if that's just rumor or I don't know. Well, Ed, do you know?
Well, what I've read, Ed, is just rumor. What I've read. There's been a lot of stuff read there. Last time I read it, yeah, that was just rumor.
Okay. All right, everyone have a copy? We'll go through this really quick. This is an excerpt of an essay by Dr. Ray Bolin from Probe Ministries, which is a Christian apologetic ministry. Something is irreducibly complex if it is composed of several parts, and each part is absolutely necessary for the structure to function. The implication is that such irreducibly complex structures or machines cannot be built by natural selection, because in natural selection, each component must be useful to the organism as the molecular machine is built. Behe uses the example of a mousetrap. A mousetrap has five parts that are absolutely necessary for the mousetrap to function. Take any one of these parts away and the mousetrap can no longer catch mice. And so he gives that explanation there. So let's jump down. It's fairly easy to imagine the complete breakdown of functionality if you take away any of these five parts. Without the platform, the other parts can't maintain the proper stability and distance from each other to be functional. Without the spring or hammer, there is no way to actually catch the mouse. And without both the catch and hold down bar, there is no way to set the trap. All the parts must be present and accounted for in order for a mouse to be caught and the machine to function at all. And this last paragraph is one I like the most. You can't build a mouse trap by Darwinian natural selection. Let's say you have a factory that produces all five parts of a mouse trap, but uses them for different purposes. Over the years, as the production lines change, leftover parts of no longer made contraptions are put aside on shelves in a storage room. One summer, the factory is overrun with mice. If someone were to put his mind to it, he might run by the storage room and begin to play around with his leftover parts and just might construct a mousetrap. But those pieces left to themselves are never going to spontaneously self-assemble a mousetrap. A hammer-like part may accidentally fall from its box into a box of springs, but it's useless until all five parts are assembled so they can function together. Nature would select against the continued production of the miscellaneous parts if they are not producing an immediate benefit to the organism. Okay, and so this stuff is pretty hard to grapple with. Any questions so far on irreducible complexity? I'm going to read to you another example that this takes in the form of the eye, whether it's a human eye or an animal eye or anything like that. Philip Johnson basically wrote a book called Darwin on Trial, and he takes into consideration some of Darwin's ideas. Let's see here. He says, how can such things be built up by infinitesimally small inherited variations, each profitable to the preserved being? The first step towards a new function, such as vision or the ability to fly, would not necessarily provide any advantage unless the other parts required appeared at the same time. As an analogy, imagine a medieval alchemist producing by chance a silicone microchip. In the absence of a supporting computer technology, the prodigious invention would be useless and he would throw it away. Does that make sense? So let's say by chance somebody invents something really cool like a computer microchip back in the 1800s. Well, if they didn't have a computer, there would be no use for this microchip, and so they would toss it. It would not benefit them whatsoever. Stephen Jay Gould asked himself the excellent question, what good is 5% of an eye? And speculated the first eye parts might have been useful for something other than sight. And Richard Dawkins, who is the gentleman who wrote The God Delusion, he responded with this. An ancient animal with 5% of an eye might indeed have used it for something other than sight, but it seems to me as likely that it used it for 5% vision. And actually, I don't think it is an excellent question. Vision that is 5% is as good as yours and is very much worth having in comparison with no vision at all. So is 1% vision better than total blindness. And 6% is better than 5, 7% better than 6, and so on, up the gradual continuous series. The fallacy in that argument is that 5% of an eye is not the same as 5% of normal vision. For an animal to have any useful vision at all, many complex parts must be working together. Basically, to have any percent of vision, one must have 100% of an eye. Okay. So even a complete eye is useless unless it belongs to a creature with the mental and neural capacity to make use of the information by doing something that furthers survival or reproduction. And he goes on to talk about how the hypothesis that people have explained away this eye example is that they said, well, it first started out with light-sensitive or heat-sensitive pigmented skin cells. And so over time, it was useful for them to have these heat-sensitive skin cells, and so they would pass those on, and eventually there was a mutation that occurred that, you know, all of a sudden, not being heat, they were also light-sensitive, and they could detect light and all of this kind of stuff. He also goes on to talk about the wing, that if it's true that animals evolved from, you know, walking creatures to winged creatures, the wing was probably a little mutated arm or something. But the reality is, if it was a mutated arm, it wouldn't have functionality until it was a full-on wing with feathers. It would not serve the purpose of flight, and would therefore be something that would further their life in any way, shape, or form. And so, like the microchip example, yeah, it's cool that one has a deformed part, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's useful for them at that time. Just like the microchip would have been completely useless in the 1800s, had somebody just, wow, look at this cool thing I found or I made, but they had no computer in order to use it. So you need the whole system. Any other thoughts, or anyone ever heard this before? And I mean, this thing has a lot of traction, I think. Irreducible complexity is hard to argue with in a lot of arenas. So, all right. Well, the next thing I have for you, and the rest of them must be on the copier, and just to show you that I don't know how to use that stuff very well, I've managed to staple it on the bottom versus on the top, even though there's a little graphic of one up there, so don't be confused. It opens up. So you might need to restaple. And it's also backwards. Like, it's supposed to... Anyway, the type A's out there may not come back to class. So, Betsy's around, I'll go get the other ones.
Do you want,
yeah, that'd be great. It's the copier down at the other end. So, all right, this is an excerpt from William Paley's Natural Theology, Watch and the Watchmaker. And this has been an argument that I touched on last time, I think. But I want you guys to have a chance to read it in its entirety. About 3 pages. And it's going to kind of talk about what Dave Newell, he stayed after class and was explaining to me his experience flying with his son last week. And basically what he was saying is when he's flying for American Airlines, he's way up there, like 30,000 feet or something like that. And you can't really see the features of the Earth because you're above the clouds. But when he was flying at 13,000, 12,000 feet in this little prop plane with his son, he basically said, your survival is dependent upon you can find roads and man-made structures to land on. Like it's not like you're going to find a big airport. You just, if you need to, you have to land somewhere. So you look for roads or man-made things like that. And he said his eye, when he was flying at 12,000 feet, when he was going, his eye was immediately drawn to anything that was seemingly man-made, that had purpose. It had design, it was straight roads, you could even see, you'd come across a forest and it would be just kind of just everywhere, and then you'd see a clear-cut acreage field and you'd see farm patterns. And he said your eye was immediately drawn to anything that had design and purpose. And you knew immediately, well, that's not just by accident. That's a man-made structure, and I need to know where that is just in case. And he said even, he thought it was interesting because they even went by a reservoir, and the water line was low. And so there was a white line on the rock edge that was above the water where the water could used to be. And he said, yeah, for a minute there, I thought that was also designed and made, you know, because it was so perfectly straight and even. And I said, but wouldn't we appeal to the idea that it was designed? Because everything else we see like that is designed. So why wouldn't we say that didn't happen by accident either, but God, in his perfect designing way, creates gravity. And water can't sit unlevel, it always sits level. And so it's going to sink level. It's not going to have like a jagged water line, you're going to have an even water line. And so that too is a remnant of design, just like everything else that he was seeing that was natural and straight. So so with William Paley's The Watch and the Watchmaker, read this, and if you guys want to, what would be interesting for you is write a response why you think this is an inadequate explanation of design. Because I'm going to bring in some examples of people showing, and atheists and philosophers showing that this is an inadequate explanation of design. And we're going to discuss theirs. And so it would be interesting that as you're reading this, look at and read it as a skeptic. Read it as someone who disagrees with this idea of design, and find your own loopholes, find your own problems or circular reasoning or anything and say, that's not satisfactory. Okay? And probably a 1 to 2 page, you know, write out of this. So.
Single spaced or double spaced?
Double spaced. It gives me room to put my grades in my comments. If it's single spaced, I can't write spelling error. And it's interesting how students sometimes try to cheat on line spacing. Like they'll go 2.003 and it just spreads just a little bit and gets it to the second page so they make it. Or they'll put their font at 13-point font. Well, I tried all that stuff, so I know how to detect it. So, go ahead, and that'll be done. We'll be done for today, unless you guys have any questions, and you guys can have a little while. You can read this or go about your day. Anything else? Okay. Next week we move on to the argument of analogy, and this watchmaker is going to play a crucial part in that. So. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.